Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 2, The Activities of Maharaj Agnidra. Text 14. Yo sa tvaya kara saroja tapatango Dikshu brahman brahmata ijayate shinime Muktam na te smarasi vakra jata varutam Kasto nilo harati lampata esha nivim Yo sa tvaya karo saroja tapatango Dikshu brahman brahmata ijayate shinime Muktam na te smarasi vakra jata varutam Kasto nilo arati lambata esha nivim Yo sa tvaya karo saroja tapatango Dikshu brahman brahmata ijayate shinime Muktam na te smarasi vakra jata varutam Kasto nilo harati lambata esha nivim Yo sa tvaya kara saroja tapatango Dikshu brahman brahmata ijayate shinime Muktam na te smarasi vakra jata varutam Kasto nilo harati lampata esha nivim Ladies? Ya, which, aso, that, twaya, by you, kara saroja, with the lotus palm, hata, struck, patanga, the ball, dikshu, in all directions. Brahman, moving. Brahmata, restless. Ijayate, disturbs. Akshini, eyes. Me, of me. Muktam, scattered. Na, not. Te, your. Smarasi, are you mindful of? Vakra, curling. Jata, of hair. Varutam, bunches. Kasta, giving trouble. Anila, wind. Harati, takes away. Lampata, like a man attached to women. Aisha, this. Nivim, lower garment. Translation, my mind is already restless, and by playing with a ball, moving it all about with your lotus-like palm, you are also agitating my eyes. Your curling black hair is now scattered, but you are not attentive to arranging it. Are you not going to arrange it? Like a man attached to women, the most cunning wind is trying to take off your lower garment. Are you not mindful of it? Please repeat. My mind is always restless. And by playing with a ball, moving it all about, with your lotus-like palm, you are also agitating my eyes. Your curling black hair is now scattered, but you are not attentive to arranging it. Are you not going to arrange it? Like a man attached to women, the most cunning wind is trying to take off your lower garment. Are you not mindful of it? Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. The girl, Purvachiti, was playing with a ball in her hand, and the ball seemed like nothing but another lotus flower captured by her lotus-like palm. Because of her movements, her hair was loose, and the belt holding her cloth was giving way, as if the cunning wind were trying to make her naked. Yet she paid no attention to arranging her hair or fixing her dress. As Agnidra tried to see the girl's naked beauty, his eyes were very agitated by her movements. Translation again. My mind is already restless, and by... Actually, there's no harm in repeating. But maybe you can repeat in your mind. It will help to make it less restless. Maybe. My mind is already restless, and by playing with a ball, moving it all about with your lotus-like palm, you are also agitating my eyes. Your curling black hair is now scattered, but you are not attentive to arranging it. Are you not going to arrange it? Like a man attached to women, the most cunning wind is trying to take off your lower garment. Are you not mindful of it? Omajana Tamranda Shah Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Umlitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stavitam Yena Bhutale Swaya Rupagadamayam Dadati Swabadantikam Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shivasri Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama, Rama, Hari, Hari. I generally don't have a very good memory, but as I was reading the verse and purport just now, I was reminded, maybe also it's because Gita Nagari Prabhu is in my direct eye line, but I was reminded of something that he said here in a class earlier this year, in April maybe. Anyway, his whole class, very nice class, was basically talking about the attachment that the living entity, and particularly in his class, that man has for woman, like that. And in this translation, where it says, like a man attached to women, and I think also this was the thrust of what he was saying, maybe to put it into a sutra form, that those who think that there are men who are not attached to women, firstly, actually, there are always exceptions to the rule. But I think in this particular case, the exceptions are extremely rare. Extremely rare. So for those who think there are men who are not attached to women, and I think as a general rule, those who would think like that would generally be more women than men, because men are living in men's bodies. And they know what it's like to be living in a male body. So those who think that men are not, there are men that are not attached to women, except for that. Can you see the gap between my fingers? If you can see the gap between my fingers, then it's too big. So those who think that there are men who are not attached to women are naive. And those men. Who think they are not attached to women are dangerous, deviant and dangerous. And this is the universal problem that we have as far as possessing a material body is concerned. This attachment to sense gratification, attachment in, you know, essentially as Prabhupada always explains. I remember also many years ago a Bhagavatam class that was given by one devotee, and he was making this point that this purport and this verse is making, and the point that Gita Nagari Prabhu was making, and the point that I'm trying to make today. And he was making this point very strongly that the attachment, and this is the, and Prabhupada says it many, many times, Bhagavatam says it many, many times, that this is the greatest attachment in the material world, sex life. And at the end of the class, a devotee put up his hand and asked a question. And this devotee was a reformed heroin addict, junkie. And he asked the devotee the question that in his experience, when he was a heroin addict, there was a far greater attachment for him, there was a far greater attachment to heroin than there was to sex life. And it was an interesting question. I thought it was an interesting question. I've never been a heroin addict yet. But so I was intrigued by the question. The answer that the devotee gave, the short answer he gave, was also interesting. He said, yes, but when you were a heroin addict, had you given up sex life? Were you free from sex life? And of course his answer was no, he wasn't. So the devotee said, so, you may have felt at that time that the pang or the push or the craving to take heroin was the number one priority, but it wasn't that it freed you from the desire for sex life. Anyway, it was interesting. It was interesting for me because how we emphasize something and the stress we put on something that we take from Bhagavatam or that we take from Prabhupada, we repeat, of course, but it also helps if we have realization. I remember also I was giving a talk. I had just been reading in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam about childbirth. And of course, as all the ladies in the room, or at least all the mothers in the room, of course all the ladies are mothers, but I mean it in the context of those who have had children, will testify that it's a very dangerous territory when a man starts to speak about childbirth. At least I've been told that by my wife. It's not a good idea. But anyway, I've just been reading in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam the whole pastime about childbirth and how distressing it is and how essentially it's when the child is delivered through the canal. What's that? Anyway, it doesn't matter. When the child is delivered, that there's a lot of force that is put on the head. And you even see that, I've seen that subsequently actually, that often when children are born, their heads are quite elongated. You know, and you kind of think, I remember the first time I saw that, I kind of thought, God, that kid's going to be really weird when he grows up. You know, because like the head was about that narrow, you know, and about that long kind of thing. You know? I thought, God, you know. I wouldn't like to have a head like that. Don't really like the head that I have either, actually, when I come to think of it, but I certainly wouldn't have liked to have had that head. But of course, you know, over time that changes and the head takes shape. In fact, I recently learned that the only things that keep growing throughout our life are our nose and our ears, which for me is a little bit of a problem. It's big enough as it is, but apparently the nose keeps growing. But anyway, that the head, it readjusts itself over time. And it becomes more proportioned, as we see most of our heads are now. Anyway, I was reading this part in the Bhagavatam, and it was really, I was really convinced by it, which is a good thing, I suppose, that we're convinced by what we read in the Bhagavatam. It would probably be a bigger problem if we weren't convinced. So I was reading this part, and it was really convincing. And basically the point that was being made was the distress of childbirth and the distress that the child goes through at birth is essentially what leads it to forget its constitutional position as an eternal servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because prior to that, in that same section of Bhagavatam, it's being described how while the baby is in the womb, the baby is conscious of its constitutional position, and it is conscious of its precarious, difficult, unfavorable situation that it's in the womb. But then, through that process of childbirth, it forgets all that, and then it becomes like us, you know, one of these living entities that's going through this material world. At best, as it says here, the mind is always restless. At best, and as Krishna tells us in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that the mind is always restless, but by practice and detachment, we can pull it back and we can control the mind. But essentially, our minds are never stop being restless, really. So through that process, that baby forgets everything. So I was stressing this at a Sunday feast talk that I was giving many years ago. And you know, sometimes, as is our, we all have different natures, but as is my nature sometimes, I'll really get into stressing a point and really, really stressing it. So I was really fired up about this point, so I was really stressing this point. And at the end of the talk, the Sunday feast talk, a guest put up their hand to ask a question. And this, by the way, was about 30 years ago. So it was quite a considerable period of time ago. And as I said, you know, women, mothers will tell you that men are not best placed to talk about childbirth, what to speak of 30 years ago. And practically I was only a kid and I knew absolutely nothing about it. Except what I was reading in Bhagavatam. So this person put up their hand and they said, so what happens in a case of cesarean section? Because I put all the emphasis on the baby being forced out through this narrow canal and that's being the distressing thing, causing the whole thing. And I stood there and I was, I didn't say it out loud, but I was thinking to myself, gosh, I never thought of that. That's a good question. Why did you have to be here today? But, you know, given our ability to think a million things in a second and whatever and be a little bit inspired maybe by Super Soul, I said, yes, of course, in those situations, the second part of our forgetfulness kicks in, and that is that we're surrounded by so many family members and they're all telling us how cute we are. And you know those scenes, I don't know if any of you have been at those scenes. I have two children myself, so I've experienced this a little bit, that whenever the family, you know, your own family, your wife's family, get to see the baby, you know, the whole discussion that takes place while the baby's there is, oh, he looks like his Uncle Joe, or she looks like her Auntie Bessie, or he looks like his granddad Billy, you know, looks like his grandma this or that or whatever. And this conversation can go on endlessly, actually, about who the child actually looks like. And isn't he so cute? Isn't she so pretty? Isn't this, isn't that? So there's this whole kind of thing, emphasis that's put on the bodily features of the child. So that was my answer to this particular person. But the reason I just brought that up, it just came into my mind right there, actually, the restless mind. The reason that I brought it up was that it is good that we have as deep a realization as possible on what we're reading in Srimad Bhagavatam. And it's not just a superficial surface thing, because people can ask us difficult questions. I remember that question that Prabhupada was asked one time. I can't remember, was it a Bhagavatam class or was it some other address? I can't remember actually, maybe someone in the room can. But Prabhupada was stressing the point about Krishna is unlimited and Krishna can do anything. There is nothing that Krishna cannot do. And Prabhupada again was really stressing that point. So then when he finished speaking, somebody put their hand up and they said, so does that mean that Krishna can create a rock or a stone or a mountain, that he can create something that he cannot lift? Because obviously he must be able to do that if he can do anything. But at the same time, if he then cannot lift it, then he can't do everything. He's limited in what he can do. So again, when you hear those kind of questions, you think, that's a good question. Good in the sense that it's a clever question. It may not be a spiritually good question, but it's, you know, it's a clever question. You know, it's the kind of question you don't want to get asked yourself. So Prabhupada's answer, and of course Prabhupada was just instantaneous in his answer, he said, yes, Krishna can create a mountain that he cannot lift. But as soon as he creates it,
then he can lift it. But then he can create another mountain that he cannot lift. And then as soon as he creates it, then he can lift it. And so on, and so on, and so on. So the person was very, very satisfied with the answer that Srila Prabhupada gave. So here in this section of Bhagavatam, we have the prince, who is the son of Maharaj Priyavrata. And Maharaj Priyavrata has gone to engage fully in spiritual life. I'm not sure the exact phrase that's used, but that's the gist of it. He's gone to fully absorb himself in samadhi like that. Which brings up an interesting question, which just to throw it out, I'm not personally going to discuss it, but it brings up an interesting question that by engaging in active devotional service, can we not also achieve the highest realms of devotional life? So in our case, by engaging in the ISKCON movement that Srila Prabhupada has created, by active preaching, etc., active engagement, is that not enough? Or do we have to do what Maharaj Priyavrata did? Anyway, I wasn't going to discuss that. But that's what Maharaj Priyavrata has done, and now his son has been given the kingdom, and his son is not married. And then he decides that, you know, he would like to have children. He prays to Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma arranges for this lady to come, this Apsara, Purvachiti. But then in this section, it's very much describing, because the prince is described as Dharma Vaikshamana, which is the epitome, the essence of Dharma. So this is these are glorious personalities that we're discussing and glorious personalities that we're talking about. And when I said, you know, there's that tiny percentage of men who are actually free from attraction to women and attraction to sense gratification in the form of sex life. You know, these are the types of personalities that you would put in this category of being free from that. But this section is describing that even incredible personalities like the prince, they also get distracted. It's described how he's meditating and his eyes are half open, half closed, half open, you know, milk, the bottle is half full or half empty. And of course, Prabhupada explains, and we know that the reason that eyes are half open and not fully closed is because if you practice yoga with your eyes fully closed, how many times have you been there, you know, thinking to yourself, you're sitting down, you want to do some reading, and then you feel a little tired, and you think, well, I'll just close my eyes for a few moments and just sort of, just my eyes are feeling a little tired, you know. And then, you know, 2 hours later, you know. Oh, well, at least it's a nice ringtone. If you have a nice ringtone on your mobile phone, then you can leave it on, and when it rings, you can switch it off quickly. If you have a not so nice ringtone on your mobile phone, then please turn it off now. I had that experience a few days ago before I came here. We were in a little gathering of devotees, and a devotee's phone rang, and it was that, I think it's an old Fleetwood Mac number, you know, boom, 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 you know? And everyone looked at the devotee and said, what have you got that? I mean, you know, just use at least the generic ringtone that the phone provides, you know, why have you got that ringtone on your phone? So if anybody has that ringtone, they can put it on silent, you know. Anyway, that's a nice ringtone. Reminds us of Vrindavan, you know. So, but I have forgotten what I was saying. What was I saying? Who can remember? Falling asleep, thank you. Half eyes closed. So, Prabhupada explains that if you have your eyes closed, practicing yoga, then, you know, you'll fall asleep. And there are so many yogis who do that. At the same time, you don't want to have your eyes fully open and be fully alert to the external world, because that will be a distraction. So the prince was absorbed in yoga with half-opened eyes. So in that sense, you know, his distraction was greatly minimized. But then he heard the ankle bells of this Apsara, Purvachiti, and that distracted him. And now we get into this whole discussion of how he was distracted and what it actually led to and how that distraction takes place. And of course we have other examples like Vishvamrita and Menaka, same principle of the trying to be absorbed in yoga. And Prabhupada of course makes gives the explanation that in both cases the best way, and we also know as devotees, as aspiring devotees, as practicing devotees, we also know how difficult this is anyway. But this is what Prabhupada explains, that the best way to avoid being distracted by the material energy is to engage yourself 100% in devotional service. So to the degree that we find ourselves still being distracted, we can understand that we're not 100% engaged in devotional service. We may be 90% engaged or 80% engaged, and the lesser we are engaged in devotional service, the more we'll be prone to the distractions of the material energy. So Prabhupada explains like that, that's what we should do. And of course for us, to whatever degree we are engaged in devotional service, we have to be convinced and we have to understand and we have to have the realization as to why we want to increase that absorption in devotional service and not keep it at the level that it is now, allowing ourselves the opportunity to be distracted by the material energy. So why is it that we would want to be fully engaged and fully absorbed? So Bhagavad Gita of course tells us abrahma bhuvanal loka, that from every planet in the material world, from the highest planet down to the lowest, all are places of suffering. Why are they places of suffering? Because repeated birth and death take place. And we just talked a little bit about at the beginning about the misery of childbirth, like that. So repeated birth and death take place. So this is the situation that we're in. We have to die. Die from this material body. This material body will die. There is nothing more guaranteed. They say the only two things in the material world that are guaranteed are death and taxes, like that. Although devotees are pretty good, actually, at avoiding taxes, that's for sure. Anyway, I won't refer to my last class here, but, I'll just say one word, changa. Just think of changa and taxes. Anyway, death and taxes are the two things that are guaranteed. And, of course, Maharaj Yudhisthira, when he was asked that question, what's the most amazing thing in the world? His response was, ahanyahani bhutani. The most amazing thing is that every single day, every single moment actually, every single moment, it is an amazing realization to try to develop. Because we live on average, well, I suppose the Bible tells us 70. So that's 70 years. Bhagavatam says, Kali Yuga, the best you can really expect or hope for, if that's the right way of putting it, is 100 years. So let's say 100 years. How many people in the room are older than 50? Their bodies are older than 50. So it's probably, a lot of the women aren't putting up their hands. I mean, come on. Don't be shy, ladies. I don't want to embarrass by pointing out who I think looks more than 50 that hasn't put their hand up. I won't do that, I promise. Again, my wife has trained me not to do that kind of thing. So, it looked about 50% actually of the room are more than 50. So, you can more or less be guaranteed that more than half of your time in this body has gone. And probably substantially more than half. And some of you are more than 60. So now we're getting into 2/3 of your time has gone. But it's interesting that still that amount of time, how many people in the room are under 20? Yeah, okay. Oh yes, of course, you're under 20. And you can tell by you, because not just by the way that you look, but I won't. That would be as naughty of me as pointing out women who are over 50 that didn't put their hand up. But there tends to be a frivolity and a frivolness that takes place when we're younger. And the natural progression is we mature with age. So there is hope for you yet. So we mature with age. But the tendency is that we think 50 years, 60 years, 70 years is a long time. There is a real tendency to think that it's actually a long time. But of course we know in the context of eternity it's absolutely nothing. So Maharaj Yudhisthira is saying that at every moment, unlimited, unlimited living entities are dying. At every moment, there's practically no limit. And we're just in that queue. And you remember that computer game many years ago called Lemmings? I don't know how many of you remember it, but I never really got the point of it actually, but anyway, I did observe it a few times, and it's just these things just inevitably walking to fall over the cliff. And at any given time, there's dozens of them just falling over the cliff with another unlimited amount of them just heading to falling over the cliff, falling over the cliff. That's us. That's the situation that we're in. We're falling over the cliff. And falling over the cliff means that we're leaving this body like that. So to hold on to that realization, that really creates a sobriety for us. We become very, very sober if we can actually hold on to that realization. We become very, very sober. And then we can, in the same section of the Bhagavad Gita, we can actually see what the solution is, or what the solution is, antakale chamam eva, and yam yam vapi smaram bhavam, and that is chapter 7. Let me just get it here. Chapter 8, actually. Yeah, that's right. Chapter 8. So antakale chamam eva, and whoever at the end of his life quits his body remembering me alone, at once attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. And yam yam babi smaram bhavam, whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. Attain without fail. So this is the whole goal, to actually at the time of death. There's an interesting pastime with Srila Prabhupada. You all know it actually, because it refers to the famous quote from Srila Prabhupada that you won't find in the Veda base actually, but famous quote that every devotee probably in this room has used at one point in time, where Srila Prabhupada says, your love for me will be shown by how you cooperate after I'm gone. So we all know that reference, right? We all know that reference. But it's interesting because recently there was one devotee, he was looking for that quote, and he put out on an email forum saying that he can't find that quote anywhere, and he wanted some, you know, pramana for it, some direct evidence, because again, going back to what I said earlier, it's good when we're speaking that we're speaking from from a solid base, you know, not that we can be challenged and defeated on what we speak. So he was asking for the evidence for that particular quote because he can't find it anywhere on Veda base, etc. So Bhakti Chiruswami, who'll be coming here shortly, I think, he commented that he was in the room when this quote was actually spoken by Srila Prabhupada, and he gave some background to it. And the background to it is actually very interesting. That each day, this was only, we're talking now, you know, a number of weeks before Srila Prabhupada left his body. It was very close to the time that Prabhupada left his body. And just going to put this here. It's a little frustrating, this book. Okay. Srila Prabhupada, a couple of weeks before he left his body, and in the morning, Tamal Krishna Maharaj would come in and he would read any letters that had come for Prabhupada that day. So one of the letters came from some devotee, some disciple of Prabhupada. I can't remember his name. I'm not sure if Bhakti Chirumaraj gave his name. He wasn't a particularly well-known or famous devotee. But anyway, he wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada. And he expressed how he, you know, devotees, that they're getting news at the temple of Prabhupada's situation, and everyone's very concerned about Prabhupada's situation, etc., etc. So he wrote and said, Prabhupada, I would like, if there is any way possible, I would like to give you my life so as that you can continue on with your mission. And me, this useless soul, me, I can be the one that is leaving now, and that you have another 30, 40, 50, whatever it may be, years to continue on with your mission. And Srila Prabhupada's reaction, according to Bhakti True Maharaj, was very interesting, because his reaction more or less was, he didn't say it quite like this, I'm ad-libbing now, I'm not saying verbatim, but his reaction, Prabhupada's reaction more or less was, you know, that's silly. I mean, it's silly anyway, it obviously is silly, because it can't be done, you know, even if Prabhupada, you know, wanted to do it, which he didn't, but even if he did, it can't be done. So it is, it's essentially silly. It's kind of a nonsense thing to, you know, it's quite a sentimental thing to kind of express like that. And the other point is that even if it could be done, it doesn't really make any difference, because again, it's just another 20, 30, 40 years and Prabhupada would be in the same situation anyway. You know, these material bodies, we have to leave these bodies like that. But it was at that point that Prabhupada said, and what he did say was, that is not important. That they were words that he said. That is not important. What is important is that you show your love for me by cooperating after I've gone. That's actually the context that he gave that quote in. So that's the most important thing, because no matter what, at some point Srila Prabhupada will be leaving anyway. So therefore, the way to express this love for him, the way to, this devotee was expressing it by saying, you can have my body, that's how he was expressing it, but the way to actually express this love for Prabhupada is by us cooperating together after Prabhupada is gone. And that, of course, applies even now. That applies even now. It applies for all time. But it applies, you know, even more, you could argue. Prabhupada was saying that to his direct disciples, because everybody then was a direct disciple of Srila Prabhupada. How many disciples of Srila Prabhupada, direct disciples of Srila Prabhupada, do we have in the room right now? If you can raise your hands. I know obviously we have Pankaj Jangri and Janinivas Prabhus. Anybody else is a direct disciple of Srila Prabhupada? So when Prabhupada was speaking those words, everybody that he was speaking to in the room and everybody that was listening to those words at the time was a direct disciple of Srila Prabhupada. Now, as evidence, and I'm sure that this snapshot, we're in Sridharmayapur, we're in the international headquarters of the Hare Krishna movement, you can be pretty sure that there's likely to be a higher percentage of direct disciples of Srila Prabhupada in a place like Mayapur than there will be in many other centers that we have around the world. So it's a good snapshot. So how much more it applies to us who are not direct disciples of Srila Prabhupada to cooperate, and what to speak of when there are no more direct disciples of Srila Prabhupada present on this planet, the importance for that principle of cooperation to be there. Anyway, so Prabhupada was expressing like that. So for us, Srila Prabhupada wanted nothing more for us to continue on with his mission, spreading the Hare Krishna movement, the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. But of course, we can do that so much more effectively if we are not distracted, as the prince was in this particular scenario, distracted by the material energy. By us actually undoing this, what's known as the Hridaya Granti, or the hard knot in the heart of material attachment and attraction to sense gratification. This thing is, in one sense, it's simultaneously an easy thing, we understand, and it's all ultimately comes by achieving the mercy of the previous acharyas and the mercy of Krishna. But of course, we also understand that that mercy, although it can be causeless, and in the context of it being available to us, it is causeless, at the same time, we create a much better opportunity for us to benefit from that mercy if we're desirous of it. And one way that we can manifest the desire that we want that mercy that's available to us, one way that we can manifest that desire is by working hard working hard. I just read another quote actually just yesterday from Prabhupada, where he's criticizing this principle of the spiritual master infusing spiritual advancement and spiritual knowledge to disciples through the electric shock system. I presume that was something that was prevalent in India during Prabhupada's time. Maybe it's still prevalent in India. I'm personally not aware of it. I don't really sort of have any contact with anybody in India outside of ISKCON devotees, but so maybe it's also still prevalent. But Prabhupada was really criticizing this principle that the spiritual master imparts spiritual knowledge through some kind of, you know, mystical electric shock kind of system. And Prabhupada says, no, the only way to advance in spiritual life and the only way to become a pure devotee is through serious, really serious endeavor in the bhakti yoga process, and particularly shravanam and kirtanam, hearing and chanting, like that. So that's how we can make ourselves available, make ourselves much more worthy recipients of the mercy that is available to us, like that. And sometimes mercy, it's interesting, sometimes mercy and karma can be hard to reconcile, in the sense that mercy, and it's interesting actually, Prabhupada in a class in 1970 in Los Angeles, Prabhupada was giving a class, and he quoted a personal favorite of mine, so it's really nice that Prabhupada quoted it, but it's, anyway, what he quoted was, "The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as gentle rain from the heavens above. It is twice blessed." And this is taken from a section from a Shakespeare, and Prabhupada says that. I think he says, if you listen to the class, I think he says, "You're," because he's in Los Angeles, which was interesting, but he said, "You're," because, you know, Shakespeare was born in a place called Stratford-upon-Avon, and did he ever leave the shores of the UK? Maybe he did, maybe he went to Venice. But anyway, Prabhupada says, "You're Shakespeare-y." Shakespeare-y is what he calls him. So anyway, it was Shakespeare that Prabhupada was quoting from a play called The Merchant of Venice. And The Merchant of Venice is very interesting because basically, really quickly in a nutshell, there's a chap who needs a loan. And I know you have experience of this, some of you have experience of this in Mayapur. Actually, this may be interesting for me to say this actually now. This has just popped in my head, this wasn't planned, but anyway. You probably have experience, some of you in Mayapur, of lending money. So either the principle of money lending is either you're lent the money, somebody lends you the money, or you lend somebody the money. And the idea is that you get the money back. And usually you get the money back with a little bit of interest, so you get a little bit of extra money back. So some of you may have had that experience here in Mayapur of either being lent money or lending money. I don't know. Anyways, so in this particular Shakespeare play, there's this person, his name is Antonio, and he needs some money to start up a business. And he's a very sincere, genuine guy, you know, and he needs that. So there is this person in his town, Venice, it was Venice actually, and his name is Shylock. Now, there's possibly a little bit of stereotyping going on here, because Shakespeare was a Christian, and Antonio was also a Christian. And I presume at that time, probably Catholic, if he was living in Italy. Anyway, they were Christians. And Shylock was a Jew. So there may be a bit of stereotyping. But Shylock was the moneylender. And he lent the money to Antonio, however much it was. He lent it to Antonio to start up his business. And have a guess what? His business didn't work out. How many times have we had that experience? Or do we know of devotees who have had that experience? They have a great business idea, and it doesn't work out. Anyway, Antonio's business plan didn't work out. He obviously didn't do enough market research in advance. But anyway, his thing didn't work out. And Shylock wanted his money back. And there was a clause, a small print in the contract. How many of you have ever signed a contract without reading the small print? How many of you have ever done that? You want the money, you want the insurance policy, you want the house, you want the this, you want the that, and they say to you, just sign here. And you think, that's all I have to do, sign here and I get what I want? Yes, that's all you have to do. Then there's about 57 pages of small print after the page where you sign, which of course nobody ever reads. Or how many people are downloading software from the internet? And it's free software, whatever it is, you know? And the first thing you have to do is you have to accept their terms and conditions. And I think it even usually says, have you read our terms and conditions? Yes, no, accept, or whatever it is. How many people have clicked the yes, I accept button without reading the terms and conditions? How many people have done that? Okay. And everyone else who didn't put their hand up is lying. Everyone has done that. You're just too lazy to put your hand up. So that's what Antonio did. He signed on the dotted line without reading the small print. Now, in Antonio's case, it was particularly a problem because the small print said, if you do not pay me my money back on time, I can cut a pound of flesh from your body in the region of the heart. So, I don't know how many of us have had a pound of flesh cut from our body in the region of the heart, but my guess is that we probably wouldn't survive, particularly in medieval Italy, you know, 500 years ago. So Shylock wanted this. He wanted to evoke this clause. And in the court, there was nothing that Antonio's solicitor, who was actually a lady, she was very, very clever. She was a wonderful, she was the best solicitor of her time. But because she was a lady, she wasn't taken seriously. So she dressed up as a man and called herself Portia. So there was nothing she could do in the court because it was there in black and white. And the knife, I think, was even handed to Shylock for him to do this, to cut this pound of flesh. And her second last plea was this quote that Prabhupada gives. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as gentle rain from the heavens above. In other words, it's unlimited. It should be unlimited mercy, the principle of mercy. So she was pleading to Shylock's higher nature. And it's very interesting, actually, in the context of, you know, the Brahmin still being hungry but losing his caste. Shylock did exactly the same thing. What he did was he didn't accept the plea of mercy. He ignored it and basically said, no, I want my pound of flesh. And that's where that phrase comes from, of course, people wanting their pound of flesh. And he says, no, I want my pound of flesh. So he takes the knife. But then Portia, as I said, very intelligent lady, she said, okay, you can take your pound of flesh, but you must remember that you, in the contract, it says you can take a pound of flesh, not an ounce more, not an ounce less. And also you cannot take any blood. You cannot take anything else but flesh like that. And if you do break the contract like that, because you'll be taking this person's life, you also will have to lose your life. That's the punishment that you will receive. So then, of course, you know, once the issue of losing life comes in, going back to what we're talking about today, that no one wants to lose their life. We all want to hang on to these bodies for whatever reason, but we're all trying to hang on to these bodies. So Shylock also, not having any spiritual realization, he certainly was attached to his body, that he didn't want to take that option. So therefore, Antonio didn't lose his life. He walked free. He didn't have to pay the money back either. So Shylock got no money back, and he was exposed in the court as being a callous, ruthless, merciless rascal that he was like that. So Prabhupada quotes that. So mercy and karma, sometimes there can be a conflict, at least in my mind, there can be a conflict between mercy and karma, in the sense that we understand that the Krishna and Lord Chaitanya and Krishna and Lord Chaitanya's devotees, that they give unlimited mercy. There is no limit to the mercy that they want to give. So why are we suffering so much in the material world? And of course the answer is a simple one, that mercy is unlimited and is coming from others. Karma, we are the ones responsible for our karma, nobody else. It's not that whatever karma we're receiving is the responsibility of others. It's the sole responsibility of ourselves. So in that sense, the whole idea of mercy and karma can be reconciled quite easily. So, given what's happening here and how easy it is for everyone to be distracted, what time is it actually? What time are we in? Pardon? Alright, so I'm way over time. Okay, so I'll finish on this. The two things here that we can learn living in a woman's body and living in a man's body, the two things are that a real man is not somebody who, I don't know if all of you understand this phrase, I'm sorry it's a colloquialism, but it's certainly some of you will understand it. A real man is not one who's able to pull the girls. you know, who's able to, you know, seduce women and get whatever women he wants. That's not a real man. That's a wimp. That's a person who may have some material quality of attractiveness or whatever, but they're actually wimps. That's what they are. They have no control over their senses, and they just want to exploit others. In this case, they want to exploit women. And real women are not those who set out to lure men. Because, hey, just to let you know, it's a really easy thing to do. It's not an achievement to lure a man. It's the easiest thing in the world that you can do, like that. So it's no, you know, sort of kudos to do that. It's a very, very simple thing to do. A real woman is a woman who protects men, actually, from their weakness, which is to be attracted to the opposite sex like that. I was going to say a few words about Rathayatra, Lord Jagannath. It was related, actually, to what they do in Jagannath Puri at least once every 19 years, where they actually change. I only came to know about this recently, where they actually change the deities, the actual physical wooden deities of Lord Jagannath, and the process that they go through in order to do that. But unfortunately, as usual, I've spoken for too long, so I'll have to stop on that and let others. Maybe you've already heard that pastime in the last few days anyway. Okay, thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki, Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Go Premanandi, Hare Hare Bo, Hare Krishna.